Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, and a special guest today, Greg Glazer. And I wanted to introduce Greg and let you know that he is a licensed attorney in California and the founder of Civil Action Network. He focuses in the area of constitutional law and is an advocate for fundamental rights. And I know that this show is going to be quite controversial, especially with the major news in the headlines this week regarding vaccinations and autism. But we are going to give them a chance to speak. I also wanted to mention that Greg does other types of law, contracts, real estate, wills, and trusts besides his advocacy work for our rights in America. Greg, are you there?
Yes. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
We're very pleased to have you. I wanted to check, is that Civil Action Network, is that the www.trucan.com?
That's the one.
That's the one. Okay, just letting everyone know where they can reach you and read your writings. And also, Alan, you were the one who introduced me to Greg, and always pleased to talk with you. Our time together on the radio show goes really fast each week. And if there was any way, anything that you wanted to say as an introduction, Alan?
Well, just briefly, of course, it's always a pleasure to be here, Debbie, and I am real excited to have Greg today. Greg has researched our topic of discussion today in a way that I have never seen done before, with the depth and clarity and insight he's put, I'm sure, at least a couple of hundred hours into researching and writing a 30 or so page memorandum on the constitutionality of forced vaccination in the context of pandemics or declared martial law outbreaks, that sort of thing. And it's a really critical question for reasons that we'll get into, and not a short answer question, but Greg is, I'm very proud to say, is a professional panel member on the Pandemic Response Project, which, as you know, Debbie, is a project I founded having to do with the idea of reforming primarily state laws, emergency health laws around the country that in most states can mandate vaccines without exemptions in a declared emergency. And so our topic today is directly pertinent to the Pandemic Response Project and work we're doing with that. So I'm really excited to have Greg on to help explain some of this to us.
Take it from there, Greg.
Introduction there. Yes, I did complete recently a research memorandum on the topic of forced vaccination quarantine in the event of martial law or pandemic. It's a topic that received a lot of attention back in the earlier days of this country and then even 100 years ago, but we haven't had a major issue with this in at least the last 70 years, 60 years, outside of World War II. So it will be very interesting to see the next round of bioterrorism or attack, which prompts the nation to reconsider these very important issues that have just been collecting dust on the law bookshelves.
Yes, it just today I heard on NPR that they opened up the session. I think it was in the Senate introducing the reading of the Constitution once again as a daily occurrence. I don't know whether you heard about that, but the Constitution is really in the people's minds today, and their freedoms and rights and how it applies to them. I think they really want to learn more, and that's why it's wonderful that you're here to educate us. So do you think it is lawful for government powers in a republic to force vaccination or quarantine in the event of a declared martial law, war, outbreak, or pandemic, as you were starting to talk about that?
Yes, I would answer that. It depends on who you ask.
Okay.
Not an unusual answer for an attorney to come back with. But
you answer a question with another question. Well, then can you give us the different types of people who might be responding to this question and in what way they would respond?
Yes. There are two primary camps of individuals who would respond to this question. One comes from the medical military establishment. This would be someone like Lawrence Gostin, who's a legal scholar on the topic. And they would make the point that historically there is a depth of authority that allows the police power to institute forced vaccination, forced quarantine in the event that there's a public health crisis, and that procedural due process, which requires hearings and right to counsel and things of that nature, are the sufficient safeguard for protecting individual rights in such an instance. So for example, let's say that there was an outbreak of cholera in San Francisco, and the local authorities determined that they wanted to institute quarantines in certain neighborhoods. Well, they might just go ahead and do it, and then institute military hearings, either in bulk or individually, to monitor the rights and the timing and the procedures surrounding the quarantine and the vaccination process. So that would be the medical military establishment response. But there's a whole other camp, and this is the naturopathic camp, the homeopathy camp, which is pretty unheard in the legal scholar community, because there's a dearth of law reviews on this topic coming from people with a naturopathic background. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write my legal analysis, was to give some airtime to that issue. And what I found is that in trying to analyze this major question objectively, is it lawful for government powers in a republic to force vaccination or quarantine, I found that the medical military establishment may have it wrong. They may not be giving enough protection, and they may be exceeding their authority. And that's a really important point in a constitutional sense, because originally the government cannot receive more authority than what it was given by the people. And mm-hmm. So the main power under which the government is claiming the authority to regulate the public health is called the police power. And the police power means that the government can protect the health and safety of the community in the same way that we're used to in a police sense. But the right to police originally came from the people engaged in self-defense. So it really has its origin in self-defense in a traditional aspect, but it has taken on a life of its own in the new modern regulatory state. And so a lot of these issues in terms of quarantine are simply untested in the modern world, especially when it comes to modern warfare and modern bioterrorism. So the next round of bioterrorism, from whatever source derived, will put the Republic, I think, to a great test.
We saw with the recent pandemic, I think just a hint, not at all a full testing that I think you're referring to, that perhaps was implied as potentially coming or maybe even inevitable. By the pandemic, we had some real interesting measures taken, Greg, in the pandemic. As you may know, in New York, they actually mandated the swine flu vaccine for a time for healthcare employees. and there was a small, but percentage-wise, but loud and vocal objection to that from many employees, and a much quieter discontent by a larger percentage of that community. But as I find in my work, when I'm contacted by nurses pretty regularly over the last several months, as hospitals have been implementing new vaccine mandates for healthcare employees, and usually that's flu vaccines, but not always exclusively that. There's a quiet, there for every person who calls me and says, what can I do to resist this or get out of it? I'm always hearing about a small crowd behind them who is too timid, too afraid of losing their job, too afraid of rocking the boat to raise the issue, but who are nonetheless quietly opposed to it. But as I was reading your memorandum the first time around, I realized that a critical piece of this issue has to do with the fact that we are a republic. I mean, our Pledge of Allegiance says, and to the republic for which it stands. And I realized on reading your memorandum that I didn't have a clear understanding of what a republic is, and not something I hear a lot of reference to, other than the Pledge of Allegiance, perhaps, on any regular basis, that we are a republic, and yet that seemed to be an understanding of just what a republic is and what its implications are to this issue seemed to be really fundamental to your memorandum. Could you talk to us a little bit about what a republic is, what we are as a republic, and how that factors into this question about the constitutionality of forced vaccinations?
Yes, it's a very important question. A republic is a form of government that combines both democracy, which is the right of the majority to rule, and individual rights. And the balance between these two competing ideals is held in check by two basic forms of checks and balances. One is procedural checks and balances. That's checks and balances between the three branches of government. And then another is just by the raw intellect of the people and their desire to adhere to the social contract that they have with one another. And I think that both are failing today in a major sense. The checks and balances between the branches of government is very thin, as we find the New World Order military-industrial complex with its fighting these endless wars and allowing the legislators to be, in a sense, taken over by, and you know, this gets talked about in terms of the revolving door between legislature and industry, you know, all those sorts of things with regard to the New World Order. So that's the problem with checks and balances.
You're saying that there is too much overlap between the people who are in government and making law and people like lobbyists or being bribed or other kinds of influences, and they're not purely objective in their motives and the way that they are creating bills and legislation and approving these types of procedures and legal things,
right,
in the government. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. The laws today are written by lobbying firms that are like mills, and they're written by the very industries that are regulated. And although this may have a value in the sense that you want the experts to be writing the rules governing the experts, there's a particular danger because the goal, it seems, hasn't been to advance the public welfare in all situations or to advance individual rights in all situations, but rather to secure the hegemony of the self-proclaimed elites, to advance unending wars and to advance United States hegemony in industry. You know, if you need an oil pipeline protected, contact the United States government.
right.
You know, and that has been the sort of the modus operandi of this country over the last, I don't know how many decades.
I want to get too far off on a tangent, but Greg, do you have any thoughts about what we might do as a society to address that? I know one of the things that came up in the vaccine arena just about a year ago when the director of the CDC announced that she was changing jobs from director of the CDC to president of Merck Vaccines. And there was another more recent announcement about a former NIH official being hired by a pharmaceutical company to a position that included overseeing vaccines as well. And it seems to me with that sort of revolving door, and I believe that was the figure speech you used as well just a couple of minutes ago, that it would be virtually impossible for people in federal agencies to maintain their objectivity or to be free of influence. Or in the legal arena, there are problems even if there's only the appearance of possible conflict of interest. For example, if a judge happens to know a witness personally, maybe he would do a perfectly good job anyway, but just the appearance can be the basis for which you can ask for the judge to recuse himself and put another judge in that case, for example. So what could we do to fix this? Not a fair question, perhaps, but yeah, the revolving door. I mean, it seems to me that there ought to be laws preventing people in industry from going directly to positions of in federal agencies and vice versa without some significant period of time between the two, or perhaps even ever in some situations. Is that the solution, do you think? Or
yeah, I read a book on this topic. It was called Crimes Against Nature by Robert Kennedy Jr. And what I found is that the problem is more fundamental than even the experts are addressing. The problem relates to the whole two-party system and the lack of independence in thought, and also the desire to promote omnibus legislation over legislation that's going to benefit and protect the public in a reasonable sense, and allowing people to take responsibility for their own risks and pay for the harm that they cause. And so These are fundamental problems that can't be addressed by more legislation in terms of like campaign finance reform or term limits and stuff like that. That would just be a Band-Aid. And so until we can unseat this false dichotomy between the right and left and really get to the root issues of what we stand for as a republic, as a society, and how we're going to protect the environment using the great technologies that are available today, and also prevent further and escalating wars just to protect the profits and the hegemony of the powerful, we're not going to be able to address the revolving door problem until those first issues. And if we do address those fundamental issues, the revolving door problem will take care of itself. Of course, in order to do that, I think what we would need would be something like a full-scale reboot of constitutional government.
Yeah, I was talking to Alan about that just yesterday, that you have to topple what's there and start again with the pieces of the good pieces and rebuild. And I don't see that really happening unless there's like a complete and total depression of the economy and everything else, or everybody gets up, stands up and votes and says, we don't like this anymore. We're just not going to move until it gets changed. And what I'm seeing out there are so many organizations that are doing good works. So I really do want to make this a positive kind of talk, that yeah, there are so many environmental groups and so many people standing up and wanting to see transparency, like the Gulf of Mexico. They're talking now that they didn't fix the problem and that these types of oil spills can still occur. And why should we continue to allow these types of drilling offshore when we're just damaging the environment, not just for our region, but really the whole world?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm not hopeful for a violent revolution in this day and time, but I tell you, a system collapse seems to be a possibility.
Yeah, a peaceful revolution and a revolution rooted in intellectualism, I think, is the only viable solution here because, for many reasons.
it's like we're talking like Gandhi now, huh?
right. The skinny lawyer who helped overthrow the British Empire. yeah, you know, if if we had a situation where there was a peaceful proposal of a new constitution and set of laws that were to unseat all of the current omnibus legislation promoting fundamental rights but still keeping in place the tools necessary to maintain law and order and clean up the environment, we would have a really viable option for continuance of government. And I think to do that, we have to recognize some very key points. One is that there is a very advanced military-industrial complex that is operating almost outside of nations at this point. And so, you know, the state of high technology today is so so advanced and dangerous that it's very difficult to talk about going back to the types of regulation that were proposed by the founding members of the country. Mm-hmm. It's a different world. And then
it's not a Boston Tea Party here.
Yeah.
We've set in motion so much in place, but I also was telling Alan yesterday, you can't really turn back the time, the motion of time. Where we are, we have to take it from this point. So what do we do if there's such a state of technology that is outside the bounds of what we consider what the Constitution set in place?
I think the answer is that we take a very managed risk. I think that the management part relates to putting in place a new currency system that can unseat the current military-industrial complex, which is continuing to cause these problems, you know, the 130 bases across the country, the massive investment in the continuing war machine and eco-crimes. So that's the money side. And then the second would be the constitutional side, where we reboot all those laws. And then in terms of allowing people the ability to provide for themselves and contribute to the system, that's the a different component of the management side. We need to ensure that there's the money in place and the infrastructure in place to maintain these very complex systems like the nuclear stockpiles and the nuclear power plants. You know, these things can't just be shut down, you know, right away. Or, you know, think about all of the surplus sites. You know, these need to be, you know, managed in a structured manner. And if you just withdraw the funding and the infrastructure to them, you have a meltdown of sorts. And so mm-hmm. it needs to be a real, and then think about all of the water rights in place. You know, how do you manage that? And so there needs to be a very phased transition toward new secure systems. But I think there does have to be a, you know, very, very managed phase out.
All right. So you say that we have high technology in all of these other areas. Do we have the people power and the technology to institute the kinds of phase transition as you're speaking about? Is there enough energy within the people and the system to do this kind of transition?
That would be the risk component. I don't think anyone knows. But I think that what we can determine is that the current course of action is being managed by, I think we've kind of entered into a behind-the-scenes aristocracy where the world is currently being managed by those in boardrooms, you know, and not your typical boardrooms, not your, like, Sears Tower boardroom, but like Bilderberg-type meetings, you know, Club of Rome-type meetings. And I think that the goals of the individuals in power, as has been revealed by certain independent journalists, is to basically depopulate to a certain level, to, you know, try to promote a new utopia for the select, you know, hundreds of millions who will stand at the end of the of what's coming, and which really raises the next the importance of this topic that we're talking about right now, because this forced vaccination quarantine will be one of the practical aspects of the coming turmoil that could hit the century. You know, when I look at the independent research that relates to the New World Order and how these folks have been managing the managing trends to capitalize on resources and power, I see it leading toward more war, actually. And I think it would play into the hands, Deb, you raised, and Alan, you both raised the issue of a peaceful revolution. And I think it plays into the hands of the elite controllers, the self-proclaimed elite controllers. If people are acting in a callous way, in a violent way, all that does is it justifies, in the eyes of the scared public, the need for greater control. And the ability to self-govern is one that is managed very carefully. It requires multiple layers of community, stability in the home, stability in education and public health, and then stability in commerce. And just to kind of tie this back into our main topic of vaccines, I look at the history of forced vaccination and forced quarantine, and dating all the way back to the very first cases of the Italian quarantine ships, that were the ships that were quarantined in the Italian ports because they were concerned about these diseases coming from overseas. And over hundreds of years in that era, the local authorities gained the power to control because of these great fears that people had about what was coming into their communities. And keep in mind, these were the days of homeopathy. I mean, these people, everything was organic back then, and all of the remedies were these natural type of I heard it from my grandma type remedies. And so that was a time of very, very intense authority by local government over the people to quarantine and to to quarantine because they didn't have vaccinations, but they did have forced remedies and forced medical procedures. And so this is
we had that in America coming into Ellis Island. We had all of that same kind of thing. And just this past month, the realization that the people in Haiti have a disease, contagious disease, due to somebody coming in from the outside, and they didn't have natural protection. So this is current.
Yeah.
This is not just history.
Yeah, exactly. And the historical trend shows us that these processes of quarantining people were always managed through one thing. It was always commerce. It's so interesting. It was the ships in commerce that they started the quarantining, and it was public health authorities, local public health, back in New York during the old polio days, the cholera days, in Philadelphia. It was because local public health programs were providing for the poor and providing these local health measures that they gained the authority also to quarantine. And so, but it's only been very recently that the federal government has taken over the power in the fight against terrorism to institute these public health programs that are quasi-military, quasi-public health. And they have done so on two levels. One has been through legislative cooperation. The other has been through financial cooperation. And the two levels do have interplay, because when a local government is in need of financing, the federal government will come to its aid. But in the process of giving aid, they will require that certain measures be taken. And
right.
So we've seen lately a lot of acquiescence to the control of the federal government. And so that's sort of a bellwether for federal control. And the reason this relates to due process is because due process is the sort of the last safeguard that we have for your life and liberty and property to prevent the government from, taking it over. And it used to be that if you didn't like one place's regulations, you just go to the next town. But when you have federal control,
right,
where else to go? And so due process will really be the last bastion of hope for fundamental rights in this quarantine and vaccination stage. And we don't have a case since Jacobson versus Massachusetts covering this. Alan writes about Jacobson in his book, and I write about it in my memo. It's a little bit too detailed to get into here, but suffice
the gist
say,
of it?
Certain authorities interpret it to allow forced vaccination. Others interpret it differently, and it's so we'll see.
Boy, there's a load of questions in there with what you've put on the table there, Greg. I wanted to go back, if I could, on just a couple of points. The Congressional Research Service addressed several different pandemic-related legal questions and during the pandemic, and one of the questions they addressed had to do with, and they concluded that the federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents directly, and health has, and this is, I think, a fundamental problem that Republicans and perhaps some others have had with the Obamacare, the idea of the federal government mandating health care in any way, because there's a question about whether the federal government has authority to do that for state residents, because health, I think, historically has been seen as a state law level issue. But what is interesting about, and the CDC has a really interesting example on their website where they talk about different levels of authority and the overlap, potential overlap of that. So we have in this country perhaps as many as, I guess depending on how you count, 3 or 4 or 5 different levels. There are local authorities, state authorities, federal authorities. There's the World Health Organization, international authority, and then we have a separate tribal authority having to do with Native American Indians in this country as well. I'm not personally clear on that point and how its distinction, other than the obvious, referring, I presume, to Native American Indian and Indians and tribal lands. But I think the starting place is that the World Health Organization deals with international events, things in particular, for example, it's the international health regulations from the WHO that govern vaccine requirements for international travel between different countries. Obviously, if there was some sort of threat of a disease coming in from outside of the country, that would be a federal concern, or federal concerns also include U.S. airspace as federal authority, or travel between states becomes a federal issue. But wholly within a state is, at least initially, a state or local authority, as I understand it. But what is interesting is that two things about that. First of all, it's my understanding that any level can invite any other level in, so that even though there might be an issue that was wholly within a single state, if state authorities want to invite in the federal or even international authorities, maybe if it was Texas or a border state, you know, something near an international border, if they had some other reason. But the example that the CDC gave on their website was an international airport, and that could be something in the heart of our country. It could be in Kansas. If there's an international airport in Kansas and an incident there, that could trigger jurisdiction for local, state, federal, and even international authorities. And so it seemed like the initial concept was clear, the lines were clear, but then they quickly get blurry. And then we also have, for example, military regulations that give the military authority to assist with quarantines and perhaps other things relating to the hypothetical situations we're concerned about in the future here too. So for me, there's a curious mixture of clarity and ambiguity or lack of clarity in terms of who really has authority when or where in, for example, concerning an epidemic or pandemic or outbreak situation. Do you have any thoughts, or I don't know if you concur with my understanding or not, do you have any thoughts or comments on sort of that general notion of who has authority when and why?
Yeah, I do. I would concur and add only that the higher levels of federal government are allowed into state matters unless the Constitution prohibits it. Interestingly, martial law is not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, but the suspension of habeas corpus is mentioned in Article 1, Section 9. It could be suspended in cases of rebellion or invasion. And
for lay people, what does that refer to, suspension of habeas corpus?
Yeah, it means that the right to petition for your release from like a civil commitment proceeding, but probably best would be to take an example. So imagine that you come down with contagious tuberculosis, and so your local city says, all right, well, we're going to lock you up in the hospital because, you know, you keep going downtown to buy apples. So you say, all right, well, I disagree that I should be locked up. I may be contagious, but I'm not that contagious. So you file a writ of habeas corpus for your release from the hospital. And so during times of martial law, habeas corpus is suspended. So you have no way to secure your release other than through whatever channels the government will give you.
And this raises, if I could jump in here quick, this raises a point, a question that came up with part of your earlier conversation as well, where you made reference to due process and referring to procedural due process, where you're talking about you know, the right to counsel, the right to a hearing, and so forth, if you disagree with something that's going on. I think the one of the huge problems we have in this arena with pandemics and epidemics and so forth is that in our legal system, where there is an emergency, due process rights can be temporarily suspended because of the nature of the emergency. And the examples I always give, and surely there are abuses of this, but just to make the point, is that we would generally, probably most of us would agree, at least generally, that if a child is being severely abused physically or emotionally and a state official has sufficient information to believe that that's going on, they ought to be able to take the child out of the home and then have a hearing as quick as possible. But a future point, rather than give the parents notice, as would occur in a non-emergency situation, and say you're going to have a hearing next month, we want you to be prepared for this, because in a situation like that, the parents might kill the child in the meantime or leave town or do something that would prevent some proper remedy from occurring. But the question that always comes to my mind in recent times anyway, with the idea of suspending rights, as you know, there's a bioterrorist attack or some natural pandemic or infection, and people are going to be ordered to get vaccines or be quarantined or whatever, you know, the specific issue is. And in the context of a declared emergency, many of these measures can probably be ordered and implemented prior to there being any time or without, at least in the immediacy of the moment, the right to some sort of a hearing or process where you can challenge that. And so in an emergency context, a lot of times, at least temporarily, we lose rights. Who gets to decide then? Is there an emergency, and what is the nature and degree of the emergency? And we found out, for example, with the pandemic that you can have emergencies declared where it turns out that, oops, there really wasn't an emergency. But once that declaration is made, that can trigger certain events such as a temporary loss of legal rights. And so there's a real concern on the part of many of us about how this a declaration of a state of emergency or a declaration of outbreak or pandemic can shift the rights. And could you maybe elaborate on those points?
Sure.
A little bit?
In a constitutional sense, Congress alone is granted the power to suspend the writ and therefore suspend the you know, the procedural safeguards that habeas corpus grants. But this is, it's relatively you know, untested. The only example in history is of a president who actually has many similarities with President Obama, President Lincoln. During the Civil War, there was Lincoln imposed martial law, but he did it with congressional approval. And the Supreme Court, so now we have all three branches involved here, and the Supreme Court rules on it in a case called Ex Parte Milligan. And they ruled that Lincoln went too far, even with congressional approval. You can't impose martial law over an entire country and for the entire war. They said that martial law can only exist when you have a failure at the local level, where the courts just can't work. That's when you have martial law. And so it's interesting. They said that as necessity creates the rule, so it limits its duration. And so that's our precedent from 1866.
Can you repeat that? As necessity creates the rule,
so
what happens?
It's duration. So, yeah, so our example from Lincoln is that he went too far and that necessity didn't justify martial law over the entire country for the duration of the war, because the courts were working at local levels, and so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
well, that's real encouraging for the folks who are in the some of the conspiracy theory camps. And just real quick here, when I use the word conspiracy, it's not good or bad. It's merely a theory that has whatever level of support it has. And there are some, you know, as we found out with the swine flu pandemic, in that particular instance, the conspiracy theorists turned out to be right to a large degree, I guess, depending on what theory particularly you're looking at. But this raises another question for me, because a lot of times we see our government do something that later we can point to and say, well, somebody seems to have overstepped their boundaries, but that's something we sort of figure out or conclude or get to later, and it's sort of after the fact, and it's sort of the booby prize at that point. You know, what I'm hearing you say about the case with Lincoln is very encouraging with regard to some of the scares and fears that people have that the martial law will be declared absent there being some just substantially significant breakdown, it sounds like, is what it would require for that. At which point, if you really did declare martial law over an entire country, how would you possibly enforce that anyway if you had that level of breakdown implied by what you just said? But on a less practical level, and maybe a somewhat more theoretical level, to what extent should we be concerned about the possibility of someone declares martial law whether they can or not, someone declares war whether they really have the authority or not, or whether it's really justified or not? You know, there were no weapons of mass destruction, but there was certainly an awful lot that happened that depended on, as though... on the claim that they were there. And so, you know, for me, the starting place is always what is the legal technicality, but it's also always only a starting place. You know, there's practical realities, and I wondered if you had any thoughts about that as it might pertain to a martial law declaration.
There are examples of that. Like in 1941, following the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the governor declared martial law. But then the army came in and basically took more authority than they were granted by the Declaration of Martial Law, and you know, really just set up this sort of military dictatorship on the island of Hawaii. Now, at the time, they weren't a state, but you know, it's a precedent that is that's particularly dangerous. Now this is the issue of public health authorities and the public and whether the public will comply with the dictates has been one that has just rocked back and forth through so many examples. Like, one of the particularly violent examples took place in 1893. This was a smallpox outbreak in Indiana. And public health officials, they said that infected citizens had to be under home detention, and they were entire neighborhoods were being patrolled with armed guards, and violence broke out. Civilians were so angry at what was happening to them with the quarantines. They didn't like being locked up in their houses, and certain public officials were even shot, and people just revolted. And a similar thing happened in New York around the same time period, and many residents simply ignored the quarantines and fled to, like, retreats in the mountains. And so forth. And then it was really only because the public health authorities are trying to play the odds, you know, they're just trying to get as many people as they can to comply, that mm-hmm. order gets restored eventually. It's like, you know, people can only be upset or angry or hold out for so long and it fades. But I'll tell you, the infrastructure in place right now at the federal level is so extensive that I think that this is a martial law situation, a pandemic situation, is something that the federal government would be able to sustain for a very long time.
And could you elaborate on what that infrastructure consists of that you're referring to?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, as to why they would be able to do that now, where perhaps they couldn't 100 years ago or 150 years ago.
Yeah, I think the answer is that the federal government has the ability to write its own checks through the Federal Reserve Bank. I mean, you know, there's some complex mechanisms that allow that, the Mandrake mechanism, but realistically, they have the ability to fund on a mass level the local government. You know, basically just change the badge, and then also they have these concentration camps or FEMA internment camps, whatever you want to call them, that are popping up all over the country. Indie journalist Alex Jones has reported on this, along with many others. And, you know, these are particularly telling. We also have examples where they've been running drills and successfully. Top Off 2000 was one of them, where, you know, they will go in and take over an entire community. And the greater point or the lesson to be learned here isn't that they actually have to take over the country. All they have to do is manage fear. And if you have consolidated media, which exists, and you can broadcast that fear or that, you know, that sort of controlled response, then you can manage 300 million people solely by clamping down on 2 million.
Mm. It's kind of scary what you're talking about, because they may be testing this now, or they are testing this theory now, that of how much power they do have just using mind control, and that they do have the funding to do it. I don't really know what to respond to this.
Well, what might be the purpose or agenda for someone to either create and unleash a pandemic or epidemic, and to have the excuse to implement martial law, or to just take advantage of a naturally occurring one if one happened to conveniently occur.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a rich history of false flag attacks, and, you know, governments have admitted to them over the course of, you know, when required to. You know, Freedom of Information Act requests have yielded quite a bit of information where, you know, you have rogue agents and also hired agents who are, you know, working for other forces. I think it's a misstatement to say that it's the national government that is, you know, plotting against the American people. I think that there are rogue elements in there, but they are incredibly high-powered rogue elements that are at the top and working outside of a national sense. And to return to a constitutional government, or to return to a more accountable government, we're going to need to have a lot more transparency into what the military is doing. And that's where I think that patriotism, you know, traditional patriotism is going to stand in the way. I think a lot of patriotism is illogical and ignores this history of the unending war, of these self-proclaimed elites seeking more power. And I don't put much beyond them in terms of what they will use. You know, patriotism by itself can be a very useful tool in managing the populace. You know, if I want to, take control of an entire state that's very, you know, deeply religious, I might use religious tools. If I have take control of a state that's deeply patriotic, I'd use patriotic tools. And I think that what's happening is that they're using both, and economic ones as well. And that's where I think what Deb used the word mind control. And, yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, it's a form of mind control. Not in the sense of, you know, tinfoil hats, obviously, and I know that's not what Debbie was mentioning either, but in terms of like a structured psychological persuasion. And there are some very bright minds working for the United States military to accomplish these goals. And, you know, many indie journalists have been covering this topic. You know, Bill Cooper was one of the original ones. And for those willing to do the research, there's a fertile ground.
Well, what comes to mind as you were speaking was weapons of mass destruction. That was a phrase that was heard across the nation and was used to approve a lot of legislation that we now look back on in history as saying, where was it? And then today we're looking at the transparency of WikiLeaks, and people are saying, that, you know, maybe this is not proper behavior, that he should be court-martialed or something for providing this information to the international community. So there's a lot of oppositional forces at work, and how can we know what is the best, truthful, honest way that the people can get information without causing something to be disrupted in the world, in our nation, cause a war and stuff? I mean, I'm kind of getting off the topic of vaccination, but...
Well, I'd love to chime in on that one briefly, if I may.
Okay.
If everybody knew ahead of time that their interactions were an open book, they would behave very differently than the way they do. We have evolved a system, and Greg, you probably have more insight on this next piece than me, and please feel free to supplement my comment here, but we've evolved into a system where there are certain mechanisms by which, or protocols by which, people form relationships and business gets done or politics gets done or whatever. And most of that goes on in a way that people don't intend it to be exposed. And so I can certainly see the offense at people who had things that they did not intend to be revealed, having that revealed without their consent. But the idea that we need transparency, to me, is just so profound and so fundamental to all of this. If things were fully transparent, we'd have a very different world, a very different set of things happening, I believe. But I don't even think, though, that transparency is enough, because we have such a complicated world, nobody has time to pay attention to what's going on. We need, I think, more than simply the ability for people to see what's going on, because most don't have the time to look at it, even if it is there to see. But we need some further mechanism to, in form of checks and balances in a more formal sense than just simply the ability to see what's going on. But the transparency would be a critical and necessary first step. Greg, do you have any thoughts on those kind of topics and ideas?
Gosh, wouldn't that be wonderful to see cameras go into these secret military bases? Oh, wow. What would we find? And to open the books on these technologies that have the ability to, accomplish amazing things or totally wreak havoc on the planet. I mean, that itself is a very dangerous prospect. And so I think that's where the structured risk comes in. The United States military has currently, I'm sure, the ability to just absolutely wreak havoc on the planet or be a great protector of the planet. And, you know, to what extent does the public wish to reveal those technologies? Or is that the kind of transparency that we're talking about, or is it something else? These are questions that are unanswered today and relate ultimately to one of the great flaws of our species, the assumption of risk. To what extent are we willing to assume the risk and try to be transparent and try to be peaceful with one another? Or are we going to keep doing these war games, hiding technology, keeping these secret groups? And because as long as there are secrets, there's going to be people manipulating the secrets. As long as there is these forms of consolidated power, there will be people manipulating the power. One of the great themes of humanity has been that even very beautiful things can be manipulated for abuse of power. You know, even water, which is life-giving, can be misused to hurt somebody, and it's been done. It's happening right now.
Yep.
And so,
well, I don't know how we're going to change human nature. You really talk very much and think idealistically about a utopian type of world and where people are really good to each other. I don't know how or when that's going to happen. What I actually see, perhaps from my perspective, is more of a one-way mirror, not a transparency where you see both each side looking at each other, but one side is looking at the other side, but the other side can't see through that window. Do you understand that metaphor?
Yeah, maybe you could expand on it a little more too, though.
Oh, well, when you're doing an observation, like if you're a teacher, you have an observation window, and you can see the classroom if you're a student teacher. But the kids can't see the student teacher. And in the same way, the government, they're gathering all this information, wiretapping. They have your social security number. They have everything, all the details on every person. But we don't have all the information about what's going on up there in their part of the world. That's what I'm saying. So when you say transparency, it's not a two-way mirror. It's a one-way mirror.
But in referring to transparency, I think what we're saying is that it needs to become a two-way mirror. But what I'm saying, that in a society complex as ours, even with the two-way mirror, I remember hearing people saying, referring to how foreigners were much quicker to jump on board with the problems with 9/11 than Americans were, and it was sort of like, well, we see what's happened, why can't they see what's going on in their own country? And not to change topics here, but we have, again, a very complex society, and even when the information is there, and anybody can go on the internet and find out information on any point of view on any topic that's available virtually, with the internet being what it is today. But few people will take the time to go seek it out and really apply some scrutiny to arguments on both or all sides of an issue and try to come to their own conclusion. And I don't think it's nearly so much that we lack the ability to do that so much maybe as it is the time. Somebody works a 40-hour week, and by the time you buy groceries and wash clothes and get gas in the car and everything else, you don't quite have enough time left to get a good night's sleep for the next Monday morning. And so I feel like there's as Greg was saying, from a very different point of view, I think, at least as I heard it, perhaps a need for a restructuring, rebooting, really like that phrase, of our Constitution, perhaps of our entire societal structure. I think we're running really close to the end of the hour here. Greg, do you have any comments on the extent to which you think that capitalism, the so-called free enterprise system, helps or impedes? I mean, there are people who argue that, you know, because of competition, for example, we come up with innovative products and ideas, and then perhaps on a superficial level, opposing viewpoint might say, but then it's all about the money and people's health and well-being is kind of a side issue, and with what we see going on in the pharmaceutical industry, very clearly people's quality of life and even lives are brushed aside. I mean, a little over a year ago, we had a pharmaceutical company that had $1 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar criminal fine, and a $1.3 billion civil fine. You don't get
Alan,
a criminal fine.
You have asked a question for a whole another hour. So,
I have.
Yeah, so what we're going to have to do is thank Alan, thank you very much, and thank Greg very, very much for being on. It's been really enlightening, educational, and inspirational. We do need to come together as a nation, as a group in local, state, and national level, and really stand up and speak to each other and learn from each other. I'm going to have to just say goodbye. If anybody else wants to just say a word, that's great.
Greg, thanks for being here. It's a pleasure having you. I hope we can get you back to get into this deeper, because there's clearly a lot more to explore here, and you're a wonderful resource for us. I hope you'll come back again.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Thank you. Allow our souls to shine, reaching for the great new love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your truth. What I want, we are changing the world. It takes an act of loving will to cause the change you need. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. And as its radiance grows bright, into the world it will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled.